This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Good afternoon, Catherine.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. We're getting pretty close to the end of this here little season.
Yeah. You're about to be flown up to meet all your...
I am. All the people.
All the people.
All the publishing people.
Good.
So exciting. But you know, always the question, what does one wear? Remember way back when... That we spent almost an entire episode talking about your shirt choice when you were going down to Tassie.
Do you know, my thinking on what to wear has completely changed.
Oh my gosh.
I used to think you had to have something different because otherwise people would be like,
oh, she's wearing the same thing again.
She's got the same shirt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the opposite now. I think you should have one to two go-tos.
Recognisable outfits.
And you should just always wear, even if it is... Like a unique looking shirt. I think you should have less.
Yeah. Okay. Nice. Yeah. All right. I can do that.
Yeah.
I can do that.
So what's your signature?
Oh, well, you know, like what I've recently moved on to, my first ever.
No.
Jumpsuit.
Oh, I love a jumpsuit.
Oh my God. It's so great. I mean, aside from the impracticalities of having a wee, just so great.
Yeah. I love them.
Oh, I love them too. I love them too. Anyway, I'm just going to try and work that
often in a wide leg though.
Well,
wide legs often very unflattering. If you can get a tapered
nah,
leg.
Nah, see, I've gone wide leg, little.
Oh, cinch.
What's this bit?
Cinch. Waist.
Yeah. Radio. It's not
you
that
haven't
good
worked
for...
in a clothing shop, have you?
I have.
Oh, have you?
That's what I did forever. Oh. I think that's what's happened to me, and this is not good for podcasting either, is that I've started to run out of words. And see the early onset dementia.
I actually hear you. I think I tell the same neighbour the same stories all the time.
Oh, like, really?
And I think I've only just realised it. I think she's only just started saying you've told me that before. And each time it's like a complete surprise to me. I think, oh God, have I?
I tell you what though, on Neighbours and Stories We Tell, are you listening to Fitzroy Diaries?
No.
Oh God, it's just so good.
Is it?
It's so good.
I've never listened to it.
This is the second season now.
Remedy that.
It's just very, very well done. Writers out there, if you're not yet listening to it, you should be listening to it.
Can I say my I'm going to put this as, okay, maybe not all-time favourite podcast.
Yeah. That's this one, obviously.
Obviously, yep. But I'm going to put it up there, and it's probably in the all-time favourite for non-investigative type, you know, ones that are time limited and they're, you know, this is one that goes on for a long time. It's called The Office Ladies.
The Office Ladies.
And
I do not know this one.
It's the American version of The Office.
Yeah.
Two characters in it, Pam and Angela, who don't like each other on the show, but are best friends in real life. And they're going through, they release an episode once a week and each episode of the podcast, they started at episode one of season one of the TV series, and they go through it. It's unbelievably good.
Okay, all right. Well, and do you just go from the start?
I don't know if you like it, actually.
When did we discuss this recently? Oh, no. I posted something on Instagram about, let's be really clear that Catherine and I often do not have the same taste. It was on Curtis Sittenfeld.
Yeah.
Oh, I squirmed. The short stories, you think it, I'll say it.
I haven't read the short story.
My Lord. But I could see exactly in it what you love so much.
Yeah.
And I was reading them in bed next to my partner and just squirming in the most
so
awkward
good.
Kind of delight at her wryness. And so
she's
good.
So good. That was one thing. I went to Broadside. I liked it. I'm glad it exists. All the rest. I just wanted to see Curtis in though. Like, I just wanted to she was all panels.
She was all panels.
I would have happily just sat at her feet and stroked her hair, fed her grapes.
Okay, we'll just let her publicist know that there's a market for Curtis coming and having her feet stroked by Catherine. All of that aside, you can tell that Catherine and I haven't seen each other for quite some time because we're just chatting. What we're going to talk about today, though, is getting outside of your comfort zone, because recently, last time we spoke, you were about to go and do a debate and you were feeling a little bit nervous. This was a new kind of a thing for you, despite the fact that you are a legitimate Toastmaster. Tell us.
I don't know. I am a legitimate Toastmaster. I'm not sure. That's something I want to promote heavily.
Okay, right. All right. We'll just redact that part. But how did it go? Without giving away the result.
Yep, no spoilers. It was really fun. It was really fun. The best bit is always hanging out with authors.
Always.
So my team was Robert Lukens and Jock Sarong.
Yeah.
And we were, doesn't really matter. We were on the affirmative team, which meant I spoke first. We were probably on the side of the topic that was a bit hard to argue.
Yep.
So if the topic, to simplify, the way I described it to not non-literary people, but non-literary people, was that
those
it's
people.
Really about, so if Michael Jackson is a pedophile, can we still enjoy his music? Like, that's kind of the crux of it. Can you separate
just
the
really,
art from the artist?
Really put it in the reducing crudest, that yes. to its, to its kernel.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so we were on the side saying, listen away, my friends.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Which is not something anyone would really argue. And it's literally
tricky.
Not musical. But that bit was fun. We did most of it via email, but we met up the day of and hung out and talked books. It was actually, we talked a lot about writing process. It was very interesting.
Excellent. And tell me, how did you prepare? So you were feeling a little bit nervous about it just because it was something different? Or not so much.
I think I was okay with it.
Okay.
Debating is one of those things that I had previously thought was one of my great regrets in life, having not been on the debating team, and that if I could push my children into something, it wouldn't be music, it wouldn't be chess, it would be debating.
Get on that debating team.
Because it's like it's current issues, it's looking at things from different sides, it's public speaking, all that sort of stuff. And it was a lot of fun. Don't know if I'm inherently a debater.
Is any writer?
It's a lot of rules. Even though this was like a lax, but it's like,
there's a
pretty
clear
niche.
Structure to it.
Yeah.
Tell me, how do you, in general, how do you prepare for something that you haven't done before, that you don't know well?
I listened to last year's.
Oh, great.
So
excellent.
There was an example.
Bit of modelling, yep.
I guess I just wrote a speech. And then I practiced it. So it wasn't too involved in terms of what we had to do. Probably the hard bit is, I think in life, say in Toastmasters, you're at a distinct advantage if you're good at writing.
Yes.
Because even if you're a bit weak on the actual arguments, you can kind of present something in a way that people understand.
Yeah.
But this is something where everyone is good at writing. So sort of, at a point in time, you have to accept that the standard is high.
Yeah.
You know, everybody is good at that.
Hey, did you try and be funny?
I actually didn't. I could not find a vein of humour. Robert Lukens is the standout, I would say. He was very funny, but he's
very dry in his delivery.
Yeah,
just
right? He was really good. Like, his speech is very good. He, having said that, I'm not really sure what he was arguing. Like, it was just, it was a very fun. So it's like you kind of have to stray.
Yeah, exactly.
I think he did it very well.
So you either go for the rules or you go for being adored by the audience.
Kind of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how I could have, I don't know that I could find a vein. And he did very well to find
one. You know,
one.
I think
he
that
did
this
really
is,
well.
This is tricky too, because when you said that you listened to last year's, and recently I had someone ask, they were getting ready for like their book's coming out next year, and they're getting ready for those blogs and things that you do, the 10 terrifying questions, etc. for Booktopia.
Yeah.
And I was advising them, you know, read through a bunch of other ones that have been published and then work out, like, is everyone being slightly ironic, or is everyone being very earnest? Or, because I remember that's, I did that so much just to go, oh God, are we being funny here? I can't be funny. So I always err on the side of being earnest, but sometimes that doesn't fly either.
Yeah.
It's tricky.
It is good having a back catalogue of those things. Yeah, and then when you find a good one, you just want to steal it.
Absolutely. Mm. Tell me what else this year has been a bit of a risk for you. What other times this year have you stepped outside your comfort zone in the creative space, in your writing life?
In the creative space. I restarted my novel from scratch.
Oh, that's a dramatic right.
throwing
oh
out.
Oh my gosh, I still feel deep anxiety. I'm like,
that was the wrong decision.
I'm clutching at my chest.
I could have just moved it into a folder.
Why did you not just move it into a folder?
I did not need to be quite so dramatic about it.
Just let's just hold there for a second. Did you feel like the physical act of starting again was going to give you some, you know,
it
like
was
that
no
great,
safety net.
No
it was
safety
like,
net. It was just going to make.
Like, I would have had.
I'm still clutching my chest.
emailed versions, yeah. sporadic, that would have been quite old. But it's all the clutter often, yeah. like the, oh my God, I did do something with. Like, with I did that. Write about yeah. the scene where they did. Like,
okay, so that was a high risk and you worked out not high reward.
Oh, it was the right decision.
Yeah, okay.
It was. An unnecessarily dramatic, like I actually yeah. probably would have benefited from having a few of those deleted scenes.
Sure. But, you know, great story. You can always tell the story when you completely restarted.
It's a hard call to make, though. I saw Meg Dunley, who is in our writers group, wrote something on Twitter about having that sort of crisis about sometimes you make major, major changes
yeah.
and you're sort of on the fence of, if I don't do it, am I going to be have this perpetually unsatisfied feeling?
Yeah.
Or am I just doing the equivalent of find and replace for yeah. a character name? Yeah. Like, am I just doing something that is so...
It's so hard.
Yeah.
And there's no one answer. It's different in every project. Exactly. And how can you even tell?
I'm going to turn the tables. Kate?
Yes.
What have you done this year outside of your comfort zone?
So I was thinking about this, and the thing that I've done most recently is, you know, I do a fair bit of teaching. Teaching itself is something that I'm entirely comfortable
That's
with.
That's a good thing to have in a comfort zone.
Yeah, teaching is in my comfort zone. However, this year the content that I taught on, so I did that podcasting workshop, and I did some other stuff on like post-publication and the hustle, and I was like, I'm not totally qualified to talk on these things.
How are you not qualified?
Well, but this is that thing,
Kate,
where you...
you have a podcast. You've been published.
I know.
And
well,
hustled.
This is this thing, isn't it? That like women go, we hit what, 80% of the think criteria and we're like, I don't think I'm qualified. Whereas guys like 40% and they go for the job. But I think it's that thing of having a long history as a perfectionist, which I'm just slowly loosening out of, that I used to think you had to know everything about something yeah. to teach it and, you know, and consequently learn over time that you don't have to. But I think what I discovered in doing those, each of those workshops was really successful. And I think part of what was so successful is that I was kind of on edge, like in a good way, like I was taking a risk. There was a little bit of uncertainty, like who knows where this is going to land. I was high energy because I knew that I had to bring it and it was new content. So I was finding it at the same time. So I think that was really good to learn that yeah. like pushing outside of the comfort zone in that stuff and, you know, and it worked. So you don't have to kind of have that. I've nailed 90% of the criteria, so thus I'm now willing to, you know, stick my toe into the water.
Yep.
Just jump
sort of
in.
Humility in that too, isn't
it? Totally.
There? Like that,
yeah.
That even in that, like to have a teacher that is sort of saying, there's space here for you to contribute
yeah.
your own.
Which is that viewing. That confidence thing. And I know
yeah,
that
that's true.
You know,
that's
we've
true.
Been getting a lot of delightful feedback on the interview that Charlotte and Charlotte speaking to us, Charlotte Wood, and her talking about confidence being a decision and people saying, there was
great.
A fantastic, I can't remember who did it. I'll have to look back on the Twitter feed, but someone who was saying like, I just need Charlotte to like speak to me before I go on in every event. But I think part of having that base level confidence is going, it's okay if someone yeah. says to me, oh no, you're wrong on that, Kate. Or, oh, actually, I reckon the data's kind of changed on that, which has yeah. happened in numerous of my workshops. And being able to go, oh my gosh, okay, can you stand up here then and tell yep. us all about that? And that's just about becoming more confident in myself, I think, that I'm okay with that. Like, no one's going to, well,
that's
and even
great.
If they do stand behind me and go, oh my God, Kate Mildenhall totally didn't know her shit on that. Well,
the
I'm going to survive.
Off.
Yeah. the risk pays off. So that was workshops. That was a big thing. That was a big thing. But I also wanted to mention other people going outside their comfort zone. And I think that I've loved seeing this in our little podcasty community, both online and then the Writers Victoria 80s dance party, which you weren't able to come to, but which was last Friday night and was just fabulous.
Some style and outfits.
Oh, there was some.
I was impressed with people's fabulous dress outfits. Up skills.
But what I loved so much, beside the dancing and all the rest of it, was that there were some people there who I spoke to who had really kind of put on their brave pants to come. Didn't necessarily know anyone or knew that there would be some people there that they could talk to, but had really made the decision, I'm going to go to this thing. I'm going to put myself out there. Solo arrival in 80s gear.
Yep.
There were lots of people who introduced themselves and kind of said, oh, you know, you follow me on Twitter or I follow you on Twitter or I listen to the podcast. And it's all the stuff that we've been saying, like there's an amazing network out there. People shouting out each other, people in the kind of lists that have started coming up at this time of year, you know, best books of 2019 or what to buy for Christmas, and people who do their little kind of, am I allowed to say my own book? Well, of course you're allowed to say your own book. Like, say your own book. Have loved all of that stuff. And then within, you know, our writers group and other groups I'm in, writers, particularly might I say, women writers, non-male writers, putting on their brave pants and asking for more money or better conditions or saying, nah, actually, I'm not going to do that. That's been a real feature of conversations I've had, I think, this year. And I think that's really impressive. And that's so outside the comfort zone for people to say no or pay me more or
that is exciting.
I don't want to. And so a huge round of applause for everyone who's done that in 2019. I'm very proud of you all.
It's that thing about no being a complete sentence, but could you ever imagine saying no? Just like,
maybe we should practice that. Maybe no. That's what we're going to try in 2020. Come with me. Go with me, Catherine. 2020, the year of no. No, we can't do that because
to qualify. Oh, right. Yeah, true.
We are not allowed to say no.
Okay, so what about thinking about next year?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you are going to try that makes you feel nervous?
Well, besides the bleeding obvious for both of us, which is putting out the new book.
At least yours is finished.
Mine's
not finished. Mandy's Christmas.
Let's not even talk about it. So let's leave those as great big elephants in the room. Some things I'm going to try. I have nearly convinced my sister that we are going to do body electric dancing.
What is body electric?
I think that's what it's called. It's the one where you do, I know that Mel Cranenberg does it because I follow her on Instagram and I saw her amazing glitter pictures. Shout out to you, Mel. So you learn a routine with other adults dancing and then you put on a show.
Wow.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So that I'm going to do that.
Great.
I know.
I'll come and watch your show.
Oh, you can come and do the dancing if you want as well. So I'm going to do that and I'm going to try some nonfiction writing. I've said this every year for the last 3 years. I've said, I'm going to write an essay. I'm going to write a long essay.
Personal essay?
Yeah, like a personal essay. I've just been doing, we shouldn't shout out to other things when we haven't already done this in advance. But anyway, I've been doing Sophie Cunningham's online course with Kill Your Darlings. It's terrific. Also online courses.
I know.
How clever.
I want to do a Writing for Kids one through the Australian Writers' Centre. I've heard it's unbelievable.
And there's just content sitting there whenever you can get to it. It's just there. It's terrific. So, I'm partway through that and I really want to do that. And
do you have a topic or is it, you don't have to reveal your topic?
Yeah, I do. It's something to do with camping and place.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And
I think I've spoken to you about that. Not
possession
on
and weirdness around that. So that's me. What about you?
I finally have a concept for my next novel, even though I've got to finish the one that I'm currently
working
on.
That is the sign, though.
Yeah.
Isn't that the sign?
Yeah, it is.
Hurry up and finish because here I am.
Yep, I'm
your new idea.
About this new thing.
That's very exciting.
I feel like this is a great irony that in having pursued the world of competitive public speaking to satirize it, I'm now obsessed with it. So I'm going to go in it, like, to win.
Like,
so,
big guns.
Like, actually, like, really try hard. So I feel
like
the
international.
A long burn. Yeah, that's going to be my aim. But it's a long burn. I think it could be multiple years you would have to try.
I am so excited. You heard it here first, everyone. She's in it
I
to win it.
I have watched so, I cannot tell you how many speeches, but it's a bit like how I've read a lot of, you know how I read on Kindle and you get the first chapter free?
Yeah.
So I would read multiple first chapters a week and you start to understand the pattern of what works. Whether I can execute the pattern of what works,
it's the
same with a great speech. Yeah. Like there's not a full, like there's just a way of putting something, like there's, so a good speech sort of has the best will have a short vignette.
Yeah.
That is amusing in and of itself,
yep.
Right? And it's just, oh, that's interesting and funny. And then a larger vignette that links to the first vignette,
yep.
And each enforces the other, but it's like almost a secret reveal in the way they,
nice.
It just is.
How is it, how does it differ from a good personal essay? Or is it very similar? Just the execution is different.
I think the fact that the execution is there. What is interesting about Toastmasters, and I guess the speeches that I'm talking about, and having done the workshops there, which were fabulous, is that they're much more focused on meaning and message. So it's like you have to have a story that has a message that is almost sits within that inspirational space of you can do it, or you know,
yeah.
But it just, yeah, it was really fascinating. Some of the workshops were fabulous in the way of looking at a personal story that is, or a personal moment or interaction that is incredibly small, and that's literally all you're working with,
yeah.
And how you, which is a bit like a personal essay,
yeah.
But how you tug it in every single direction
to reveal the meaning.
But it's, I think sometimes personal essays, this is a really simple meaning,
yeah.
You know, a life meaning.
That's very exciting. So how are you in your grand plan of world domination of the Toastmasters sphere? What's your training regime?
Well, I just have to enter. I have to come up with a good speech. I actually entered this year, but unfortunately there's a guy at my club. I had a good speech. It was good. He is a world finalist. And we were the only two in it. Originally, I was the only one in the whole competition at the club level. So I literally, all I had to do was turn up and deliver the speech. But then he had a late entry in. Yeah, and beat me. He's very good. So I might have to join multiple clubs, Kate.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
It's like branch stacking.
Who will I become?
To get in. I'm so excited.
To the point where this year, my work has a club and I emailed them and said, did you hold a competition? My plan was if they hadn't, I was going to ask if they would put me forward to the next round, but they wouldn't.
Listeners, can I just tell you, I have not ever seen Catherine's eyes lit up quite as they are right now. I think that one of our bonuses potentially for season 3, and listeners, please do tell if you would like this. Let us know on the Twitter. Is that one of our bonus episodes can be you doing one of your speeches?
Yeah, all right. That okay.
There it is.
That would be good.
You heard it here.
You might have to read a personal essay.
We're doing it. No. This is all about you and your plan for world domination. Oh my gosh, that's so exciting.
I think that's the note we'll go out on.
I think it is.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Sarah Hopkins' first novel, The Crimes of Billy Fish, was highly commended in the inaugural ABC Fiction Awards and shortlisted for the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. Her second novel, Speak to Me, was published in 2010. This Picture of You, published in 2014, was shortlisted for the Barbara Jeffress Award. A Sydney-based criminal lawyer, Hopkins spent years appearing for young people in the children's court. Her unnerving conclusions about the real-life levers into the criminal justice system helped inform the fictional depictions in her fourth novel, The Subjects. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So your fourth novel, The Subjects, came out earlier this year. But if we go back in time a little, did you always want to write?
So the answer is probably no, as in I spent you know, the first sort of 4 years at university, I majored in English as part of, as my, you know, for my arts degree, and didn't, it never crossed my mind really. And it was only when I was actually finishing my law degree that it was, the assignment set for me was to do a piece in any way that I wanted. So I chose a fictional approach to the right to life and the right to death. So it was a sort of a euthanasia focus. And I enjoyed it so much. A kind of light bulb went on when I thought, this is something I would really like to do more of. And so when I finished law school, I started writing my first novel.
Wow. Mm. And was that first novel The Crimes of Billy Fish?
No, the first novel is sitting in the bottom of a drawer, never to see the light of day.
And so how many attempts along was did The Crimes of Billy Fish
the second.
Come?
Oh. The second. It was yeah, that, it was my second book.
And
yeah.
So what was the writing process for Billy Fish like?
So Billy Fish was interesting because I was a criminal lawyer by then, and I was leaving prison one day. I was visiting a client, and I saw a fellow sitting at the bus stop waiting. He'd obviously just been released, and he was waiting there for a bus. And, you know, my experience with so many clients had been that they had so little direction or support when they left custody that I started sort of thinking about what his story might be. And I wrote that story. So it was very, it was sort of the social realism genre, which was different from the first book that I had written. So I, you know, I suppose I was really following that advice of write what you know. You know, I was very close to that world, you know, of drug use and crime. And so I embarked on that book.
And do you plan things out? Did you plan it out for that one? Or did you just sort of...
Look, the answers to Billy Fish would be no. I really just tried to inhabit that young man's experience as he left prison. And so it's very much a character-driven approach to writing that story. I had a sense of where it was going, the sorts of challenges that he'd face. But, of course, once you start writing, the story takes you, and that's what happened with Billy Fish. I knew that it was important to me that there be some element of redemption in that book. You know, I didn't want it just to be a tragic story. There's tragedy in the story, but I had a strong sense that there was a different trajectory that was going to be available to him.
So your work, obviously Billy Fish, but also the subjects as well, draws pretty heavily on your work as a criminal lawyer. How do you see one informing the other? Or how does that work for you? Do you always draw very heavily on?
No, I don't always draw heavily on my work. My second and third books, I always tend to have some aspect of a legal story in there or a lawyer in there, just because I suppose it's what, you know, so occupies my thinking. But, you know, again, even with the subjects, that was, you know, it did, its genesis would have been in my experience in the juvenile courts, you know, seeing how that system was really sort of day in, day out, seeing how it was failing, you know, not just my clients, but their families and really their communities. So I, you know, even then, it wasn't just the justice system that I was interested in exploring. It was all these systems that surround young people, the health system, the education system, you know, they're all sort of equally complicit in the way we fail to properly support children, particularly children at risk.
So do you see it as like a creative exploration, or do you have a hope that the novel can enact change? Like, is that part of the purpose of writing, or it really is just a more creative
look,
process?
Look, I think
it?
With something like the subjects, I'm exploring some fairly serious themes and that are very close to me and very important to me. But I'm very cautious of the idea that I'm trying to tell a message, you know, that I'm trying to, you know, create change or, you know. But at the same time, I think novels do that. I think fiction does that. You know, it does make you think about broader issues and widen your lens, your scope, through hopefully a compelling story. So I probably put more time into the planning of the subjects than I did in a way with other books. That's not to say that I stuck with the plan, but I
involved world building, I suppose, in some ways as well. Do you think that influenced the need to plan?
Sorry?
Like you've sort of created the kind of the prison or the school or the space in which the people inhabit kind of has rules, and that in itself would imagine would require a degree of planning.
Yeah. That's right. You know, the book has that sort of microcosm within it, it is a whole world in itself. So once I realized that was the environment, I had to create the rules and, you know, well, kind of the whole backstory to it as well, as in the surrounds, the broader system. And so what I realized pretty quickly was that I was in both the utopian world where I was envisaging what's the best that we could do to support a character like Daniel and his friends, and then what's the worst that we can do? What in fact are we doing currently, presently, in contemporary society, but from a dystopian perspective, how bad can this get? Where are we heading? And I guess that's what I was interested to explore, that my fears, and they're very grounded. I think they're very real. I think people working in the system now, we have those fears around what are we, what's the potential of how we're currently dealing with children in these different systems that are operating.
It's interesting, the creating a world, often I think as a writer, it's putting these characters in this particular setting that is appealing, but to make it work for the reader, you have to have reasons that sit behind it that is so heavy on the thinking and so light on the page.
Yeah.
Was that your experience?
Yeah, and I think you have to create the tension immediately. You have a sense of who Daniel is. You know, he's a 16-year-old boy. He's been caught dealing drugs in a high school. He's intelligent. He's scared. But where is he? So, you know, I think what I was trying to create there is immediately this sense of mystery and uncertainty around these surrounds. You know, he doesn't know where he is. He doesn't know who's running this place. You know, he doesn't know what the purpose of it is, but he senses that he is part of an experiment, but he has no idea, you know, really what the subjects of that experiment is or what they're trying to prove. And in a way, for me, there was that analogy with how young people feel in the system now. You know, when they go into a juvenile detention centre or when they go to school, that complete sense of alienation and uncertainty and lack of connection, that's terrifying. So I was interested in looking at that and how that might play out imaginatively for a character like Daniel, who, you know, at first appearance you might think, well, this is terrible. What's happening to this poor kid? He doesn't know where he is. But, of course, with someone who's got a background like Daniel, it's in fact the opposite. Mm. You know, this place, there's elements of paradise to this place for a child like Daniel and for the other characters like Rachel and Alex.
If we go back to Billy Fish, what was Billy Fish's pathway to publication?
So, you know, Billy Fish, it was a while ago, but he, you know, the book could have even ended up at the bottom of a drawer again. I had sent it to, like, you know, a publisher and an agent and had no luck. And then, of course, you have no confidence when you're trying to get a book out there, particularly when you haven't had one published and you don't really know how to navigate the system at all. But a friend then suggested to submit it into the ABC Fiction Awards, and that was great. Did really well. It was highly commended, and then ABC wanted to publish it.
Right.
So that was really great. And that was, but you know, I remember thinking at the time, God, it must be hard for people when, you know, when that doesn't happen. There must be a lot of very fine books, I think, out there that actually, don't see the light of day.
I think there are a lot of very fine books that don't see the light of day. That first time, what was the publication experience like?
It was exciting. It was great because it was around an awards night, and there was no, you know, it was just an offer came, and then they wanted to get it out very quickly, and the editing process was so fun. I mean, it was the first time I had had feedback on my work in any kind of detail. So I found that whole experience illuminating. I have with every book found the editing process illuminating.
I think that's one of the misconceptions for people who haven't been edited, is that that would be a very hard thing to have people provide feedback on your work. But it's such a joy. Like,
for me it is, but that's interesting that you say that, because I know other writers who don't love the process. Yeah. And I'm always surprised by that, because I just enjoy the process so much. You know, suddenly you have someone at the table with you talking about these ideas
and
you're trying to get, oh, it's amazing. Yeah.
And they care.
Like, they care. They really care. Yeah, and they tend to really like your work, so that helps, you know. So there's just being able to create that connection around it is fantastic. It feels like you're suddenly revealing all your deepest, darkest secrets to someone.
That's the harder aspect of it sometimes.
But I liked that. That was great.
And so since Billy Fish, there's three more novels that have come out. What's been the process of finding homes for all of those?
So for the next two, it was tricky because the publisher that I had stopped publishing fiction. Mm. So so ABC Fiction completely folded. So like you, I have a profession that keeps me very busy. So I really just put in the hands of my agent. Yep. And so for those next books, I try not to get too involved. I just get it to my agent, who does do a good read for me.
And did you get your agent after Billy Fish or before?
So I got my agent when ABC offered to publish it, then I contacted this agent that I'd heard about, and So I contacted her, and she was interested to do that, and has been my agent ever since. So we've had a pretty long-standing relationship.
Yeah. And most recently with text. And so how, like, looking across the course of a career, I suppose, how has the publicity, the work you have had to do around each book coming out, changed over time? Has it changed or has it not changed?
I mean, I think there's certain things that have just, they stay the same. You have this flurry of publicity, and, you know, you have to be ready for that. And, you know, it's that kind of really strange sense of laying yourself open and to the critics, and that, you know, that whole process. I find it a really stressful time when a book comes out. I mean, I guess the difference over time is that, you know, there's e-books has become a bigger thing, and now audiobooks. So The Subjects is the first book of mine that's become an audiobook, but that whole process was fantastic.
Were you very involved in the...
I went to listen to... Richard Roxburgh did the narration.
Oh, amazing.
And he was amazing. So I just went and listened to the first... I had to go away, so I could only listen to the few hours of him doing it. But it was such a joy just to sit and listen.
Is it interesting, did he have different sort of... a different way of reading to the way in which you would have read, or the way you...
Yeah, yeah. Totally. Yeah. And in fact, he really moves between the characters much more than I thought he would. I thought you just, that stuff sort of left more to the imagination, but the voice changed for the characters. I mean, it's such an extraordinary gift to be able to do that. I found it amazing.
And how long does it take him to?
Oh, days and days and days.
Yeah, okay.
I think more than he thought was going to take him. But so that kind of stuff is, I mean, so I think with this book, there's been that that experience has brought something new to it. And I've also had more sort of conversations around this book because there's been an optioning process. And so I've been, you know, that also is a really exciting one because you sit in a room with a team who kind of puts a creative proposal to you. And
as in for film or for TV?
For TV, yeah, you know, for like, you know, Netflix, yeah, that kind of.
Wow.
Know. Yeah, yeah.
Is that, and that's something that's happening or the process is just sort of starting?
It's just the it's been optioned, so that deal's now being done. But just to get to that point, you know, has involved, like I said, like a proposal being put and a meeting. Yep. And so, again, it's like the editing process in a way. You get to sit around and talk about the ideas in the book. And in fact, that's even a different thing because you talk about how you can expand the ideas in the book and where else it might go because it's such a different medium,
yeah.
You know, TV that, you know, so it's still, you know, who knows if it will happen, but
yeah. What an exciting.
Yeah, it is. That's a lot of fun.
Oh, it's amazing.
Brings a different energy to it, you know.
And so, Sarah, you also mentioned, we've spoken about you working as a criminal lawyer. How do you fit writing in around your work?
Yeah, you know, people often ask me this question as in how do you get the balance? And the balance is just a real misnomer, I think, for how you write and work at the same time. And I've also got a family, you know, it's a complete sort of crazy, chaotic seesaw. And when I'm in the midst of it, you know, writing a book, there is certainly a sense of chaos around how I exist because I'm, you know, it becomes the primary thing in my brain that I'm trying to kind of work through, but I have these other lives that I have to live as well. It's not always like that, you know. That kind of creative process, it can be calmer, but when there are just those times where it really this, you know, it needs to get out, that it's hard to fit it all in at those points. But at other times, I get up really early.
Yeah.
So I get that writing done sort of up until midday and then I'll work after midday. So I work part-time.
Yeah.
And then when I'm not writing, I'll probably work more full-time.
Yeah.
So I've got a lot of flexibility in the work that I do, which is fantastic and necessary.
And very necessary.
Yeah.
Moving on to advice. One of the things we always ask our guests is for advice, partly on writing, but really on the experience of being published. Is there any advice you would give yourself? Or is there anything you know now that you wished you knew when you first started out?
Look, I suppose it's just that thing of the older person talking to the younger person to say, kind of just enjoy it, you know, enjoy it more. Don't let anxiety creep in because there's very little you can do, I think, to control it once it's out there. And so the journey's going to be what it's going to be. And you know, it's, you just have to love writing itself.
Yeah, you do.
And I think you've just, you know, when books come out and through the whole publishing process, there's a time, I think, where it really helps not to be thinking about the next book. But then I think we have a way of finding our way back to the work. So after a certain time when all this stuff and fluff, you know, you don't really need it anymore and you need to be focusing on the next thing. Something starts creating, you know, and that's really exciting for me. I'm kind of getting there now.
Yeah, I was about to say, are you in that mode at the moment? Have you got...
And it's like your kind of safety zone in a way where you've got this thing that starts, you know, growing and building and you know, creating this kind of strange image in your head and you wake up thinking about a new character or a new story. And
so how long ago did you have the kernel of idea for the story that will come next? Like, do you sit on a...
Yeah. So I try and sit. I mean, this is not really advice, but it's just a very definite thing for me is that the longer I sit on the kernel, the better.
Yeah.
You know, I try and hold off putting anything down on a page for as long as I possibly can, like, so I'm absolutely busting to do it. And then, because I feel like then you let this, you know, the subconscious mind has this great ability to do some work without you even trying. And so for me, I try and let that whole process happen until, you know, before I really start consciously trying to structure ideas or be clear on character or particularly any kind of narrative arc. And I'm trying to do something, you know, and then I don't really have a process that once I actually start putting something down on the page, I don't have a process that I've carried over from each book.
Yeah.
You know, for one book I had white cards sitting over, you know, three desks in a line and trying to sort of move things around. You know, for this one, I am trying to be a bit clearer on the story and where it's going, because I can feel it's going to be jumping around time zones. But again, I know I'll start and I won't stick to it.
Yeah.
You know, that I think I like the idea of that sort of more genre fiction where you create this, you know, story and you know, you work out the tricks, you know, prior to actually starting to put it down. But I can tell myself already it won't.
There's no easy way. I feel like I'm constantly searching for the answer, and it's like you just kind of have to muddle through.
Yeah, and I think playing with process is one of the joys of it. Mm. So I guess that's, you know, one thing I think, that just exploring and experimenting is a great thing. Not something not to be scared of.
That's a very good note to end on. Thanks, Sarah, for sharing your wisdom with us today.
It was lovely to be here.
Sarah Hopkins, favourite novel by a debut author?
Well, the one I read most recently by a debut author was the Trent Dalton Boy Swallows Universe, and that was great.
It's meant to be fantastic. I haven't read it. I have bought it, but not read it yet. It's on my to be read. Okay, now we have the first time quick five, and you can pass on any question. For your first time, agent or no agent?
Agent.
Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Australian, New Zealand or international rights?
Australian, New Zealand.
Festival invites or no festival invites?
Festival invites.
Copies sold?
I don't know the answer to that. They reprinted, and I think there was 5,000 in the first print run, but I actually don't know the answer to that.
That sounds pretty amazing. That's it.
Great.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe 80. The First Time Podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.